Broadsword calling Danny Boy. Broadsword calling Danny Boy. Over.
Gasp, you can then tell us about your adventures with Corky.
Yeah, yeah.
Decorate is Cork. That's going to be interesting.
That's great stuff. Yeah.
Recording in progress.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Wargames, Soldiers and Strategy podcast. In this episode, Guy has some big news about the magazine and we talk to terrain guru Joe Bilton. I say we, it's actually Guy and Jasper. I'm Angus Wallace and with me as ever are Guy Bowers, Jasper Otage and Mark Backhouse. Unfortunately, Chris can't be with us.
Hello.
Missed you, Chris.
So, Guy, before we get to the news about the magazine, what else do you have to report?
I've got a lot of little quick snippets, so let's get it over and done with. And also, Angus, I promise you this time that I'm going to cut down on the amount of links, because after the salute one and after the movie one, I think you had something like 20 or 30-odd links, and we don't want you to die of exhaustion, so we'll keep it sweet. News-wise, I think first we need to mention about the whole issue which several companies have been having with their websites. Unfortunately, it's a perfect storm, and a lot of people were with trade stands and have now, unfortunately, at least temporarily, lost their websites. They do have a full list up on our website. We want to keep those manufacturers going and keep them alive. So do check out our website and do keep those guys supported.
I'll put a link in the show notes to the blog. It's on the blog, isn't it, on the WSS website?
Yeah, on the WSS Facebook page. And obviously, we hope to be able to take that page down very quickly. But it looks like it'll be at least another week.
Yeah, it's not as if all these companies have gone bust. Actually, it's just their web provider has failed, fallen over.
Well, only temporarily. It's an unfortunate, perfect storm. And as Jasper said, it's going to be another week before things are going to be sorted. And then I think everything will return to normal. Okay, so moving quickly along. Firstly, we have NAM 68, which is going to be released by the Plastic Soldier Company. It's by Warwick Kinraid and, of course, ably assisted by Piers Brand. I unfortunately wasn't able to get hold of a copy before this recording. So what do we know? Well, it's Vietnam, 1968. Play some appropriate music. Skirmish combat rules. So we are promised it will come with a campaign system and some clever scenario design, possibly involving rather sneaky Viet Minh, or if you want to use the American term, Viet Cong. So yeah, we're looking forward to that one. But that, unfortunately, is all I know. Second very brief mention. I know we've mentioned Bo Action 3 before, and there's a lot of speculation on this one. Well, Warlord have been, of course, just teasing us. They've released a few pages online, but this has caused probably more speculation. Again, I don't really want to comment. I mean, there's things like cover saves, really? But I think, actually, that's just they've got a savings, though, anyway. It's now called a cover save. That's my speculation. So, yeah, we've yet to see a copy, but I am promised that we will be getting a copy soon. Again, didn't arrive before the show. So there'll be a full review in WSS 132, which should be out in September. Now, moving swiftly along, we now have a proper review. I've actually had something to read. And this is Stargrave, Dead or Alive, which is basically the Stargrave universe meets the Mandalorian. Insert theme tune here. Woo, 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 woo. The book itself starts with some solo rules and a discussion on setting the difficulty. There's also rules for co-op play. So this is quite an interesting shift from the sort of standard Stargrave pattern of, instead of it being Wizard A meets Wizard B and decides to fight for some apparent reason, or gang A of Star Guys and gang B of Star Guys beat each other up. This takes things forward a bit more, which is quite interesting, I think. You have 20 settings, where it's basically backgrounds or environments you can fight your battles in, which go everything from abandoned mines to lost spaceship interiors to volcanic plateaus. Make sure you've got the high ground on that one. So there's 20 complications, which are basically things to add into the mix. And also there are 20 marks, or 20 targets for your wannabe bounty hunters. There are also some simple rules for gangs, because after all, a single target is going to be a bit too easy for a group to take out, and also a bestiary.
Is it like gunslingers in space?
Yeah. I think, you know, if you're talking about sort of like, you know, doing the whole Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef gang thing for a few dollars more, you've got the picture. Now we move on to our big news, don't we, Jasper?
Yeah, it doesn't come with a theme tune, though.
Yeah, we could do with a theme tune. I think Jasper's probably best at explaining things on this one than I am.
So, as hopefully a lot of listeners know, we've offered a digital subscription to WSS for, well, probably at least 10 years, where you just get the latest issue in PDF to download to your computer, and then you can read it, and you can buy back issues the same way. You know, not everybody likes that way of reading. So we have looked for a better solution than straight-up PDFs that you download. And we have found an online reading fashion of reading WSS Magazine, and we call it WSS Online. And magically, that contains all the back issues of WSS that we have. There's three or four that are missing that were published by the previous publisher, and we never got the files, so then we weren't able to reconstruct the PDFs for those. You go to the website, you can just go to wssmagazine.com, and there's a big fat banner there, or you go to e-mags.com, sorry, publishers.com, and it'll take you straight there. And you'll find all those back issues there in with a very nice PDF reader. All the longer articles you can click on, and then you get a nice reading screen, which makes for a pleasant reading on a phone, for instance. I think you can even have it read to you by computer voice.
You can.
Imitated anybody. Yeah, you can. I don't think it sounds like anybody famous.
Thank God they didn't use my voice. That's all I'm saying.
And one of the things I really like, it has an excellent search. I mean, you type in the rule set of your choice, and it will spit out all the articles that is mentioned in. So, yeah, it's going to be a new subscription type. You can see it as sort of an upgrade to an existing digital subscription. So it's a little more, it's more expensive as well, because, you know, it's all this inner, all this work and this whole back end that we had to set up.
And you get access to everything.
And you get access to everything all the time, as long as you're online. You will still get the new issue in PDF to download. And of course, any issues that you already have that will not disappear. This archive is online only. It also contains, or will also contain, all the online articles that have gone with issues since about issue 75. So you don't have to look for them separately on the blog, just all together in one big archive. And I think that's what it is. I mean, you guys have all seen it. We're sort of soft launching it.
It's fantastic. I played Honours of War the other week, and I had a lot. I thought, I wonder if when WSS reviewed it, and I did a search. Turns up 2015, I think, so 9 years ago, and in 20 seconds, if that had been typing in, and it's there. I read the review. It was great. I was really impressed with how well the reader works. I like the fact that you can go from that traditional magazine feel where you're flipping the pages to that. You've got I can't remember what the other view's called, where it scrolls more like a...
I think it's called Enhanced Reading View. I have to say, it's not been activated for all the back issues yet. We're working our way through it, because it takes some manual work to check that everything is in the right place. Enhanced Reading.
I could see that working. Oddly enough, I thought I'd really like it, and I did. I thought I would be really great before, but actually, weirdly, I was quite surprised how much I quite enjoyed the traditional PDF view as well. I think if I was reading on my computer, I'd read with that traditional view. But I was really super impressed. I think it's excellent. Absolutely superb.
That's the trick, you see. I mean, effectively, you can get the same service by using your phone, or the same service using your laptop, or the same service using your PC. And the bonus for us is, I've had people before ask us about, like, for example, we now have the maps online. But if you want to have your orders of battle, then you can click on the actual article concerned, I'll scroll through, and then have your orders of battle there and there. And am I right, Jasper, that there's also a page capture function as well?
As a subscriber, you can share a number of pages with a friend. So you can just basically just click a link and give it to your friend, and they can access the article of that particular spread.
No, it's a smart looking site at the moment. I have to say it's very easy to read through and seem very functional, even for a complete technophobe like me. You know, I was able to work my way through it, and it did seem a smooth reading experience. So I was impressed by it.
Yeah, it also gets rid of the other issue with which we had with a single page PDF reader, which is, of course, when you have, like, for example, with the game reviews. Occasionally, with the game reviews, it goes on from one page to another page, and there'll be the top half and the top half. And of course, now you can just scroll left and right, up and down, and carry on reading.
Yeah. That's not to say you can still read if you prefer. You can have the PDF in classical page by page. It's just a button that you click.
Very good. And that's available on the WSS website, which is
www.wssmagazine.com.
Well worth everybody going to have a look and subscribing.
Yeah. One quick note. If you already have a digital subscription, we can, of course, help you change it over, because there's no need to pay for both.
Excellent. So you can upgrade. There is an upgrade path. Or a cross-grade path.
There is an upgrade path, exactly. Yeah.
Excellent. Right, so let's move on to terrain. I'm not sure how many people will be aware of the work of Joe?
Joe Bilton.
I assume everyone's seen his work, but not necessarily realised who had done it. Would that be fair?
He's been in the magazine a few times, and of course he's very active on Twitter/X.
Well, let's have a listen to what he has to say.
Hello, hello. We're here with Joe Bilton, who is perhaps very well known on the internet, if you're anywhere near social media that is related to wargaming, as one of the people who is capable of creating an enormous amount of wonderful terrain in apparently no time whatsoever. We were just before we started this interview talking about a time warp that was lacking to be able to listen to another podcast he was recently on. He seems to have his own time warp abilities. When it comes to creating terrain, at least that's what it seems like to me. And because we are talking about terrain on the podcast, we thought we'd talk to Joe and see how he does it. So, hello, Joe.
Hello, hello.
How do you do it? I think what strikes me most about the terrain you make is how cohesive it is. I like to make terrain too, but I make terrain in bits and pieces. And if I put it all together on the table, it looks pretty good. I'm happy with it. But it doesn't look like it was all designed in one go and made in a space of time of about 85 minutes, which apparently you do with a 15 by 10 foot table. How does that work?
I think part of it is I have like a core set of techniques that I apply to all the things I do, right? When I'm doing a new theater or a new project, I'll do a test piece first and establish for that table the sort of color balance I want for that whole table.
So what, like when people start on a unit, they paint one miniature to see, I like these colors?
Yeah.
You build what, a tree base or a house?
Or a house. So like, for example, my Germany 45 table, because obviously I was sort of setting this table March 45. So it's not a winter table, but it's bleak, right? So the colors are quite desaturated. It's quite a bleak time. And so the first thing I built was one building. And I wanted to get a terracotta roof that had the right tone, so I established the right tone for the roof. I established the right sort of level of washed out weathering on the plaster and on the timber frames. Once I had that one, I could then build things around that piece. So I then applied the same colors and stuff to all the buildings, essentially. And I thought, I'll tweak it a bit, right? So you know, I'll do it one rooftop a bit more gray or a bit more brown or whatever sort of thing to give some variation there. But within a boundary of, like, you know, a hue and saturation boundary. And then when I'm doing the terrain, the sort of grassy and the bushes and stuff to go with that, I've got a building as a reference to go, right, this is the right tone of green, or this is the right, you know, the right sort of tone of those terrain bits and things. I think also it helps that I do things over, like you said about my sort of speed of doing things. I sort of try and do a whole project in one go. I'm not really a butterfly for the hobby, right? I only do World War II, and I only do 28 mil. And so I sort of basically go, right, now I'm doing this project. So my project now is, right now I'm doing a rural Russia project. I essentially go, right, I'm doing this thing. I plan it on paper. I need this many buildings, this many gardens, this many fences, whatever I'm doing. And then I just do that I just do that in one big go.
You're saying you're planning this. Do you just basically draw a table, or
no? It's a list of things. So I drew a table when I did my big Stalingrad table at Salute. I planned that on paper because that was based on a real photograph of part of the barricading mm-hmm. factory. Mm-hmm. So there I took a photograph and I adjusted it for a 15 by 5 table, 15 by 6 table, anyway, that sort of size. And I worked out which buildings would go on the table, and I did those buildings one by one, right? When I'm doing like a general thing for like a theatre, I just sort of go, right, I write on a list, I would like 15 houses, 20 gardens, 3 ruined buildings, a church, whatever, right? And then I just work through that list. So I'll just sit down and for, a block of time, I'll just work on that one theatre. And so everything's painted within the same sort of time frame. And if I then go back to add stuff to in the future, like my Normandy stuff, I'm always adding a little bit more to my Normandy collection. But I've got such an established color base and technique thing for those, because I've done about maybe like 60 Normandy buildings. Then adding, yeah, it's quite a lot, right? Adding in more of those.
It's a lot.
Storage will be a different episode of the podcast. We can talk about that another time.
I'll hold you to that, Jasper.
So I think it's a mix. It's a combination of establishing the sort of color scheme and feel you want to go for that reflects that theater and that place and the atmosphere of the table you want, and then doing the bulk of that table in one like terrain sitting, not like one evening, but one phase.
Don't need very many.
No, I mean, this Russian thing I'm doing now, I started it last week. I finished about 10 buildings, and I've got another 6 that need undercoating, and there's 5 more that are yet to do. So I'll probably have it all finished by end of next week, I reckon.
That would take me a year, probably. But then again, I don't work on it in such a concentrated way. But just go back real quick. When you establish your colors and your palette, do you just record them? You make a list, say, for this theater, this is my base color for buildings.
Only in my head.
Okay.
I record, like, when I paint miniatures, I've got very detailed notes for miniatures for every, this is Kashim Yeager 1944, this is all the detail bits, this is their smock, but the terrain, I sort of just remember, okay, these 4 or 5 colors are ones I like to use for rooftops and that sort of thing.
And then you do kind of, like some people paint a unit, you just have the whole unit undercoated and then color 1, color 2, then you'd have 10 buildings you do.
Yeah. So I like to do bulk stuff, right? So I'll have as many buildings as I can at a time. Obviously, right now downstairs, the shelf by the TV unit is covered in the buildings that are finished. The stuff in the kitchen, which is half undercoated. There's lots of stuff in various bits because I sort of do, like, okay, I'm going to do 5 buildings at a go sort of thing and then, paint all of their roofs. Although the Russian stuff now, it's all just wood, right? Apart from a few thatch things, the entire thing is wood. So I'm just painting the whole thing grey, brown again and again and again. But yeah, so Normandy, if I was doing Normandy or Germany, or like interesting rooftops, I would do all the rooftops. I'd do all the base colours, all the washes, and then all the window frames and whatever.
Does that go for the natural stuff too? Is your Normandy tree, your Normandy hedge different from your German hedge or from your Russian?
Yeah.
All the trees have to come on every table.
No. So I've got my sort of like standard European tree collections. I've got like 4 boxes of, sort of standard broadleaf deciduous sort of stuff. And then I've got another 6 boxes of jungle thing, which is a mix of broadleaf and also palm tree things. And then I've got a huge box of Germany trees, sort of coniferous, essentially coniferous trees, pines and those sort of things. And I've got autumn trees and I've got bear trees. And the Russian stuff, I'll probably just use a mix. I'll mix up. I have some patches of coniferous with some patches of broadleaf things and stuff. I've got a lot of walls and fences, and those are separated by theatre. We've also got a big box of general stuff.
So Is your basing the same everywhere, or
largely it is. When I've done done a little bit of desert stuff preparation for a future project, so that's obviously not quite the same. But I think my color palette I use a big teddy fur mat for most of my stuff, and it's sprayed a kind of a neutral olivey green. Like, it's quite bright, but not that bright, and it's got an olive and it's sort of desaturated. And I found actually it's a really good neutral green for most things. So the trees and stuff, I've made a custom flock mix for basing up terrain things like trees and hedges and stuff. And it's close enough to the teddy fur mat that it looks right with the teddy fur mat. It's also close enough to the trees themselves. So it actually is a really good halfway sort of blend between them. And then when I want to add more color or things to the teddy fur mat, I just use like overlay mats. So with the Germany table, I've got lots of sheets of, what was it? It was like a polythene backed dust sheet that I covered with acrylic caulk and sand and mud and stuff. And I made those into like muddy, patchy fields, and they're plowed in some places, and they sort of look like, you know, sort of muddy. So I put that on top of the grass mat for Germany, and suddenly now the area becomes this browner patchwork of farm fields. And where you see the teddy fur mat, the color is close enough to everything else that it doesn't look wrong. It looks like a grass verge for those things. And when I want to do Normandy wheat fields, I've got these teddy fur mats sprayed in sort of wheaty color, and also like not just wheaty, but also like other tones of green. And when they're placed on as well, they add a different color palette to the whole table. But where you see the teddy fur mat, it's still the right color that it doesn't look wrong. It looks like a grassy verge, which unifies all those bits together.
So it really comes down to thinking a lot about the overall picture and color palettes. Is that your background that comes through here for those who aren't blessed with such an eye for colors and shades and palettes?
Yeah, it might be. I think my day job is I used to be a science teacher, but my job now is I make D&D maps, Photoshop. I started doing that. It's actually this week is our 11th year of doing it. We sell them on drive-through RPG, and I do dungeons and forests and caves and whatever and stuff. And I think I'm quite good at getting color balances for those things. So I do a lot of, you know, my day job is actually like an art job now. So I think it's given me quite a good eye for color and sort of like telling a story with color as well. You know, like, so if you like with a Germany table, for example, if you see like color footage of the battles around that time, it's bleak, right? It's everything's gray, overcast, everything's muddy and desaturated, and everyone looks miserable, right? And so I wanted the table to have that feel. So all the colors are more muted than you might otherwise have sort of done them. You know, if you saw these houses now in the sunshine, they look great, and like, in real life, they'd be lovely, colorful buildings and stuff. But if you want to show the fall of Germany in 45 in sort of like the miserable spring, having a muted palette is a useful thing. So that's telling a story with the colors.
So if you're somebody like me and you have a more disparate collection of terrain that looks pretty good by itself, if you wanted to make that more cohesive, what would be the one tip that you would give?
Would you be willing to repaint things?
Possibly.
Like a rooftop, rooftops, that's what you're sort of seeing the most of. When you see a table, you're looking down the rooftops. Mm-hmm. And if you can make the rooftops more cohesive, then you're more forgiving of the walls of the buildings being different to each other. And this sort of comes into our map stuff, actually. It was this. You know, when you, if you walk through a palace, Versailles or something, the rooms often have very different color palettes to each other, and the floors have very different patterns to each other. Mm-hmm. And when you're down on the ground floor, on the ground level, at eye level, walking around, you don't notice how clashing these different rooms would be. But if you viewed the side with the roof off from above, it would look quite clashing, all these random patterns and random colors and stuff, right? And so with our maps, when we do our maps, we have to keep that in mind, that actually you're viewing from above, and if you do all the floors, you're seeing all the floors at the same time. And so you've got to keep cohesion between those things. Equally then, well, not equally, but the same sort of point, when you're seeing these buildings on a table, you're mainly seeing their rooftops. That's the thing you're, when you look at the whole table, you look at, what you see is the rooftops. When you get down close, you can see the walls and stuff, but you can't see everything else. So it doesn't matter if the rest doesn't look so cohesive. But if the rooftops have the same weathering style and the same sort of tonal values, then the whole thing, I think, would tie together more.
Interesting. So you'd have to sort of set it all up and then decide what most of the buildings are in tonal value. And
yeah, or just, you know, like rest. if you when you're starting a new theatre, I'm not saying do all rooms the same colour, but if you pick three colours that are tonally similar to each other, or at least related to each other in terms of like colour value, so you might do like a slate roof, right, like a sort of like browny grey slate roof, and then you'd want your if you did then red ceramic tiles to go with that, you'd want them to be a slightly desaturated grey sort of brown terracotta colour. And you might also think, well, I'll also do some shingle rooftops, wood shingle. Well, that should also be towards the grey end. And then you've got three different colours, and you can use them whichever spread you want, but because they are tonally similar, I bet if you were going to like a decorating shop, like B&Q or whatever, and you were to say to them, look at their like brochures where they have their, you know, I'm designing a room thing, what colours go well together?
Yeah.
You could probably use, or an app, or I don't know, whatever, right? To go, right, I want this colour. What other colours are tonally similar? Yeah, in the same sort of triad or whatever the sort of art term would be for that. Yeah.
You really have to try and think about it. What makes it so important for you to put so much effort into
the table?
Yeah.
I think when I started, what got me wargaming was seeing a picture of a war game table. I was looking for, I'm sort of deciding to get back into doing scale modeling. So I hadn't done it since I was a teenager. And then when I was searching online, I came across, it was like a how to play bot action video thumbnail or something, right? And I said, that looks brilliant. Like, that looks really good. Like, it's a scale model of a tank, but it's actually being used in a game. And look at the tree, it's in the little village. And so then I think the visuals of a nice table and the game taking place and the story taking place in a realistic setting quite appealed to me. So then I did a bit of terrain, sort of bought a box set, did a bit of terrain to start off. And then I really liked the fact that you could get down eye level and you could see these little vignettes like during the game. You know, like, I like that. Like, look, there you see the guy around the corner and he's by that building and it feels like, oh, down this little country lane or whatever. And then I was just driven to make the tables as immersive and realistic as I could.
What adds to that really? I mean, we talked about the big picture, but does it also mean like small details? And
yeah, I think so. I think see, the overall picture is really important. The overall feel for it, but then you also want to see little details like broken window panes and so that when you get down wherever you are in the scene, you can see something interesting. You want to sort of make the place feel realistic. You know, like I think it's been mentioned before on about how important scatter is. When you see a table that has just some things just plonked down on the table, here's some buildings, and they can be lovely painted buildings and they can look really good, but if they don't feel like they belong in a real place and don't feel like they belong together and as part of a place that could exist, then it's you sort of like you're jarred from it. If you look out in the street now, you know, look out your window and then you look at the real world, it's full of rubbish, right? It's full of stuff, random boxes, and burning cars, you know. So you see all these things and you want to give a flavor of those onto your table, right? So making a collection to go alongside those things of suitable things for the fit you're doing. So, you know, I've got a big box of scatter terrain, which is suitable for all my European things. Right? So it's got telegraph poles and it's got old cars and it's got bikes and bins and boxes and, I don't know, loads of stuff, right? And I just sort of go, out. And I've got a separate box for when I'm doing my jungle stuff because the scatter terrain that tells the story of that is different, right? And so you want to sort of tell the story of the place. You want to make it think, well, this is a real place. If this was a real town, what would be in this town. Because then when someone's looking at the table, when someone's playing on it or looking at it, whatever, they might not know what they're looking, what they're expecting to see, but they know when it's not there. Everyone knows what a town looks like, and you might not be able to instantly list all the things that define it you would see, but you know when things are missing, right? You go, oh, that's weird. And so if you can sort of like think, well, what would be suitable for this town? You can add a level of immersion that tells the story of the place.
So look around you and see what it looks like.
Yeah. Observations are a really important thing. When you're doing any table, observing the real world is important for how you paint and weather the table. Also, how you like lay out the table, you know, in terms of structure of a village or a town, where the houses go. And it's different for different places. So a German village, nearly all the German villages have their houses gable end on to the road. And so you'll have a street that is lined with gable and narrow houses with the gardens off beyond. You can't see them off they go and stuff. And then you get to like, you know, Normandy, and they're all arranged with the rooftops parallel to the roads sort of going along, right? And then also, you know, in terms of a lot of the French towns have sometimes just built just along not Normandy ones, just built along a single long road. And the houses appear, and then they sort of reach the church point, and then they fade out again. In the Germany ones, I sort of found them more twisty and turning and things. So having some thought about how you're going to lay out the table as well, like to again tell, I'm saying this quite a lot, tell the story. You're trying to tell the story of this place.
I like that.
And you're trying to send, you're trying to like place it in a space and time. And so you need to observe what those things are really like in the real world. So you can go, because when someone sees it, they'll know it's wrong if it looks wrong. Because people have seen maps and they've seen towns, they know what a town looks like. And if your layout is this like random stuff where you've just sort of gone, here's a house, here's a street, here's a church, here's a shop, it jars.
And then there's a game that has to be played on that. I was talking to a guy in preparation to this. I'm sure we've all had games where you finish the game and you go, that house that we put there, you know, that was in the wrong place and you know, sort of attracted all the attention in the game to it, and that completely skewed the scenario. How do you think about that?
Well, if I'm doing like a random like just a game of mates, then tough luck. You know the battlefield happened to have a house there and you know, shouldn't have gone in it. When I've done like scenarios, like either ones for the magazine or, you know, for shows and stuff, I play test those first at least two times. Like there was one actually I wrote first. It was one of the Belgium. I did that the one about the Chasseurs Ardennais.
The 1941.
The 1941, right. Yes, defend the village. Vinked. Right. One of my first table layouts for that I tested was awful because I had this building in a certain place. I had taken like a real aerial photograph of the village, and I had like arranged the table on that to go, okay, this is an interesting way of sort of laying out. But it meant that one particular building was so far forward that it blocked like all line of sight for the whole thing. And the entire game, like when I tested it, got stuck behind this building, and no one ever came past that building. And if they did, it was, so I had to scrap that house, even though the house was really there in the real thing. It didn't lend itself to a decent game. So that I demolished that house. I pretended that the Germans got it, yeah. So if I'm doing a normal game just with mates, then, you know, okay, well, that was the luck of the game.
It is what it is, yeah.
It is what it is, yeah. But if I'm doing a show game or something, I don't want that to be the case. And so I'll tweak things to work. At Salute in 23? Yeah. Yeah, last year's Salute. I ran a big 15-foot Normandy game with Dead Man's Corner and the village of Saint-Condemont. I obviously couldn't test that at home because I haven't got a 15-foot table at home. I can just about get a 5-foot table up. So I tested that in small chunks, right? So I didn't know until the actual day how the whole game would work as a full-length table. But I tested it as bits. Okay, the battle around the house works fine. The battle around the church works fine. This field bit works all right and stuff. What's quite fun, though, in the end, though, was actually there were like lines of sight that I couldn't have predicted when I did it in the small sections, which actually quite fun. There was one bit where the Americans had these paratroopers crossing the road, like right down into the table, and on the far other end, a German half track with quad AA came around the corner and had this perfect shot all the way across the table. It was great. It was carnage. It was really good, right? But I hadn't come up in my testing because I never tested a 15-foot table.
It might not work in all rules either.
That's true. Yeah, sorry, you're out of range. All right.
That's really interesting how it's a dynamic that makes it sometimes hard to foresee what's going to happen, and it makes scenario design, I think, certainly more difficult if you, because it's like as people sometimes say, it's a third player.
Yeah, it does. I mean, like you said about the, you know, the effect we had. I was playing a game recently with Duncan Weldon at his house. We were doing a little Burma pint-sized campaign that he'd written. And the tables weren't planned. They were planned in terms of, okay, the British are trying to get across this table and it's basically jungle. I had taken like a box of terrain and stuff over there. And I had this like Pacific jungle hut type thing. And on a whim, we said, let's put this on this hill. Right? Put this on this hill. And it wasn't planned or anything. But then the entire game revolved around that building. Right? In the end, like, the Japanese were defending that building, and the Chindits were charging that building and trying to capture that building, and everyone was putting smoke on that building, and all the jump-off points were, you know, it suddenly became, it being there became the focus for like the whole game, right? It was quite interesting, and it would have been a very different table without that building. It does have an impact on gameplay, obviously. Yeah.
Do you take? I'm sure you do, but. What consideration do you take to the actual miniatures you're using when building terrain? You know, to make the minis fit, to make sure your tank can cross the bridge, that sort of thing.
So in terms of scaling the buildings, I make sure that when I'm doing like a scratch building, the sort of the doors of the buildings are essentially scaled to the miniature.
Hmm.
Right? So I'm considering also like, you know, storage things and stuff. But if you make the doors and the windows the right size compared to a person, then the whole building looks sort of all right, even if the building's under scale. So I have this one mini that is my testament. It was a Warlord special one of a paratrooper carrying a wounded paratrooper on his shoulders, right? So I've got him. That's my testing miniature that I use for testing doorways and things. So I check doorways fit. I make sure that windows are the right height for a person to look through when they're sort of standing things. I also, a particular thing is actually when I'm doing like a ruined building and I put rubble in the building, I think it's really important not to put so much rubble that you can't stand the minis where you want to stand them, right? I have a big bucket of loose scatter that I use for ruins and things. I put a bit of permanent rubble on the terrain piece so it looks nice, but I don't do it in places where I would stand a mini. So when you go in a building, you invariably put minis by the windows to shoot out the windows. Yeah. Right? That's the main place. So I always leave that space clear of fixed rubble so that you can always place a mini by the windows. If I'm putting like a little ledge thing, I make it big enough that you could put at least a machine gun team up there. And then the rest of the rubble I keep loose so that when you're actually playing, if you need to move the rubble around, you can shift it out of the way and put your minis there and they can stand properly. Because otherwise, it can look lovely to pack a building full of rubble and with it placed and it all fixed. It looks brilliant, but if no one can stand on it or go in it, or
you're not building a diorama.
Yeah, exactly. So you are building a gaming piece. You are having to think that this has to be used. But also, you have to make it durable as well. There's things that scale-wise, you either have to increase the thickness of those things so they are more durable, or omit them if they are, you know, too fragile, too delicate, or find a material that doesn't break. When I store my stuff quite roughly, I guess. I have these big plastic tubs, and I just stack the buildings inside it, and they all go on each other, and they, you know, the rooftops sort of snuggle down to gaps around them and things. And so I couldn't have anything that was too fragile in that storage thing. So, you know, Rubicon have their set of like little lamps. It's part of their utility set, and they've got the lampposts and they've got their little lanterns, right? I had carefully on this Normandy building, very carefully put these three little lanterns round, and I painted them with OSL lighting, like so when you have like the source lighting and
object source. Yeah.
So I'd done that, right? And it was lovely. And then I put them in a box. And then when I took them out of the box, the lanterns were all missing. I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. So I learned not to bother with those again. And they were nice. I liked them, but that's too fragile for.
I've done that with some buildings too, and then you sort of try to see the building is like some inset or something. Then you could put them there, so they don't stick out.
Yeah, but these were like prominently sticking out on the sides, and they were shipped away.
It's like a hand comes by, bye bye.
Yeah, because I do a lot of games at shows. I had to also reconcile myself with the fact that damage will happen to my stuff if I'm taking it to public games, right? I was really pleased to see there were loads of families with their kids coming along and playing and picking up stuff, like picking up, opening rooftops, taking things off, picking up the tanks and looking at those things, right, and engaging them. And I didn't want to be in the situation where I was having to go, no, put that down, that's delicate, that's really important and stuff, because that's okay, buy off the go, that they'll never, you know, care about it again. And so I thought, well, I'm choosing to put on a show, I'm choosing to go to the public game. People are going to be interested. They're going to look at, oh, what's this made from and stuff. And if stuff gets a bit broken, you know, I can fix it.
That's good for you. Yeah.
Not end of the world. Mm. Especially with my ruined Stalingrad table where, you know, they break it.
It adds to the effect. Yes.
Exactly. Bombs fell.
Although, do you know what? On the evening before my big Stalingrad game at Salute, I dropped a box at the storage unit and this factory thing I had made, all these chunks broke off. And I would have left it except the polystyrene underneath it all was bright blue, and so it was very obvious. So I had to then go and do some late night repairs to fix that up. But
that kind of stuff, that's more frustrating because then it hasn't gotten damaged in, you know, if it got damaged at a show, it's with a good purpose.
Yeah, I know.
Stupid accident.
Corner, as I was coming around the corner, I clipped this corner and it just pulled the box enough that it went and it echoed through the room. And I was like, That sounds nasty. I picked it up. I could hear things rattling. I was like, oh, no.
Oh, dear.
You know, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been. Could have been worse.
Do you have a set footprint for your buildings? Or is it just whatever? Because I was thinking particularly with Stalingrad stuff, you had to have it done in sections. And those sections had to be a certain size for the boxes?
Yeah. So the Stalingrad one was more carefully planned than my sort of general stuff. So they were sort of actually, in the end, they were sort of like almost modular buildings. So most of them had an A4, at least an A4 or a multiple of A4 footprint in pieces. And then I had to think, I bought these boxes from Hobbycraft, these big storage boxes, and I worked out the maximum height I could have the buildings be that I could then stack three of them vertically into one of these boxes. So that gave me, that was a lot of planning there, right? And in the end, the Stalingrad stuff actually, I think, filled about six of those boxes in the end. quite a lot of Stalingrad stuff. There, I really carefully thought about the footprint in terms of storage particularly, and also about making them sort of modular and work with each other, because I wanted to be able to put on a smaller Stalingrad table and use fewer pieces that I wanted to and still give me a decent sort of factory layout. But otherwise, I just sort of do whatever. I mean, like I said, I use doors as a guide for basic size, right? So I use a door to establish when I'm doing like a, you know, on a bit of Fomex and I'm planning the width of the building, unless I'm basing it on a real thing, I'll go, right, okay, here's a door. I've got a door that I use as a standard template door. This is my door. What feels like a decent width for this building? What is this building? It's a house. Okay, these houses might be a door and two windows wide. Okay, so that's roughly the width there. And what's a good depth? Well, I find normally about 8-9 centimeters is quite a good depth for a sort of standard house. And then sort of go from there. If I'm doing a real building, if I'm basing it on a real building, then I frequently have to scale down the footprint of the building so that it doesn't totally dominate. Because I did this church, the church in Saint-Condamont. And if I had done that at true 156 scale, it would have been like a 2-meter church.
Yeah, it was to be big.
It was a joke, right? It would have been like, you know, the whole table would just be a church. And so I shrunk it down. I reduced the footprint, but I reduced the height by less of a scale. And then I chopped out, I think, one bay of windows as well to help it sort of fit together. And actually, it looks pretty good. And it's big, but it's not ridiculously big. It's not. It's turned out, I think, about 70 centimeters long, no, 60 centimeters long, still, as opposed to being. So it's nicer. I do like it. I'm very pleased with it.
I mean, I know you do it in batches, but how much time do you think it would take you to do just one building? I know it's unrealistic because you're doing 5 or 10 at a time.
What, like what, a Normandy house, right? My sort of standard go-to.
Yes, yes.
Normandy house. If you ignore drying time, I could do it in about 2 or 3 hours.
We need to do
One of those articles that people used to have, like, you know, this technique, this mini cost me 15 minutes on average for a unit, and then do it with a town, 60 buildings. the building cost me an hour and a half.
Questioning my life choices. Oh my God, that's 3 years of my life. But yeah, I think it's like, you know, so if I'm doing like a basic Normandy building, I'll build the structure out of Fomex. And I'll hot glue that together. Unless the roof is a tricky shaped roof, then if it's a sort of standard straight roof, it takes about 20-30 minutes to build the building. And then the next task is
take longer with Sarissa kits than that. So I'm in awe here. Sorry.
And the next thing is the polyfiller, like skinning it in polyfiller, and then either putting a brick texture or keeping it as poly. I think that's the slowest thing. Because there you have to sort of, you know, it's, you have to hold it in a certain way. I have my hand in like a glove so that I can polyfiller on it and then rotate it within other weird house glove thing to get the other sides of it. That's the longest thing. That's like an hour and a half. Sometimes on a big building, that will take like 3 hours, the polyfiller and texture stuff. And once it's done, I paint the building about an hour tops. I'm actually quite a stoppy painter, right? Like it's not that bad, but I don't fuss about like very precise painting of things. I put down base colors. When I do brickwork, I splodge on bricky colors in a random splodgy pattern, you know, and then I'm using washes and highlights and dry brushing and whatever and stuff to sort of tie it all together. And that ends up hiding the fact that it's a bit sloppy. So I put on the base coats pretty quick.
It's all about technique, I guess.
And about feel as well,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Final question, Guy.
Yeah, one final question for me, which is you've got stuff, let me see, in the lounge, in the kitchen, in storage. I've got to ask, what's the secret to spousal approval? Because your partner must be, she must be very happy with obviously.
Tolerant is the word you're looking for.
Well, I think a big factor actually was getting a storage unit to store stuff in, right? So she's fine with it being there if it's in the house temporarily, like, on shelves and stuff while it's, you know, being done. If it stays too long, then it outstays as well. But I got a year and a half ago, I got a storage unit at like, you know, like a big yellow kind of thing. And that's made a difference because now I can keep it there. Once it's painted up, goes into this thing, and it's very organized. It's a like a 35 square foot thing, got all these shelves and stuff in there. So it's super organized into this whole shelving unit is all Germany stuff. This is all jungle stuff, whatever it thinks.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it's actually made a difference to me because it also means that because previously as well, before I had the storage unit, when I finished something, it went to the loft. And we live in a small Victorian terrace house, and the loft isn't very big. And the access to the loft is through like a step ladder. It's not even got like it's a permanent step. So if I was playing a game, I'd have to get on the step ladder, hoist into the loft, get the box, come down, lower one box down. And that was a, you know, real pain. But the locker, the storage locker that I use now is only 5 minutes away from the house. And so if I want to play a game, it's nothing now for me to pop to the locker, put some stuff in. Like, you know, I can literally get it in 10 minutes. And it's just off the shelf into the car. That's much true. Better, I think. So I think, she knows that she's very supportive because she knows that it's a hobby that I really enjoy and I get a lot out of. And so she's like, yeah, cool. You know, as long as it doesn't overspill too much into becoming an inconvenience to the whole family. And when it does, I'm reminded that I've got a locker, so I take it out.
Perfect. That's very good. Excellent.
On that note, Joe, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
I'm sure we'll have something to discuss in the podcast itself.
Oh yeah, lots to discuss. Yeah, thank you, Joe. That is really cool. That is really good.
Thanks. You're very welcome.
So, Guy, when you finish your stuff, do you have a lockup or do you just move it straight to the coach house?
This is actually a big issue at present, because I'm actually slowly buying the entire world stock of really useful boxes. Because one of my sins has always been is having nice stuff and then not looking after it properly. That is bad. So I'm making sure now I've got proper packing in place and everything else. So yes, storage is a must.
Storage is a must. If not for no other reason, you have to make it look like you've got less than you actually have to not upset people with how much cupboard space you're using.
I'm fortunate in that regard because, of course, it's part of my work. So I can simply say, oh, no, it's part of my work. And also, yes, Emma is also very understanding.
Yes, very good. You've got an attic full of stuff, haven't you, Mark? You're not fancying renting yourself a warehouse?
No, definitely not. No, if anything, I'm trying to get rid of stuff rather than actually obtaining more and more stuff. I mean, Joe's megalomaniac ideas about Stalingrad and filling up, what is that, a 16-foot table, is it, with terrain in 28 mil. I mean, that's utterly ridiculous and completely mad and absolutely fantastic all at the same time. But, I mean, the reality is storing 28 mil terrain is a huge burden in terms of space, and not many of us have those resources at hand to store those. So that's increasing why I go small most of the time, and I look at some of the big terrain projects I've built in the past and think, will I ever get that out again? And I find also it's quite a burden to get it down to the club to get them playing and on a regular weekly basis when it's box after box after box of terrain. So sometimes small can be beautiful. That's not to take away from the beautiful, beautiful, beautiful vistas that he produces. And they are fantastic. But for me, that's maybe more of a fantasy, really, rather than a practical reality.
I think there's probably a lot to unpick from that conversation you had with Just. Perhaps we should revisit that in the next episode.
Yeah, we can give our listeners homework. Listen to the interview again.
Yeah, Jasper, you've already started experimenting with things, so be interested to unpick some of that. So we'll come back to that next time. So let's move on to where have we been and what have we been doing. Anyone want to kick off?
I suppose I will. Chris, who sadly can't be here, he's currently painting up a Norman army, which is, of course, one of my secret projects for a while has been to convince him.
Another one of your sins. Convincing poor Chris of all kinds of armors he doesn't want to work on.
Well, he is now, and with a passion, I may say. So, of course, I need to get a force to match him. And so I have now dusted off a long-dead Saxon project. I've got early Saxons, but I don't have late Saxons. So currently, I've dug out a whole pile of my lead pile, looking at different shields I can use, and also finding out that that big bunch of archers I had, because I counted 30 archers, and they're all Norman archers. They're not Saxon archers. One of those bring and buy purchases where it said Saxon archers, picked it up, I thought, yay, and they're all Normans.
How can you tell the difference?
Oh, the haircuts and the helmets.
Oh, they've got the haircuts, have they?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so, the helmets should be the same guy.
Oh, yeah, I can mix in one or two, but I can't use all of them, so...
bit of green stuff, extra hair on the shave backs of the heads.
Yes, you're right. So, yeah, with a little bit of work, they should be good. And, yeah, so I've got a lot of Saxon feared, quite a lot of the foot sore models, because they're lovely. So I've got some Herdman chills, and, yeah, a couple of nice character models. So that's going to be my next project, along with all the other projects I have. Oh, my God. But there you go. That's my current inspiration. How about you guys?
I've started a new project. I had been meaning to paint a lot of World War II vehicles up, but I've completely and utterly got sidetracked. And is it last week? on a whim, I rang up Penn Racket and said, have you got any AWI armies in stock? Any of them? And they went, yeah, one. I said, all right, I'll be up in an hour. So I went up and purchased it. And in a week, painted up a large number of them. And that weekend had a game of Honours of War. And then we played Little Wars TV's Live Free or Die. Which is fun. I like Live Free or Die. It's a 4-page rule set that probably needs 20 pages of errata to make for it to really make sense.
I'll pass that on.
But I think it's a really great, really interesting set of rules. There's just kind of holes in it. You're kind of, well, there's a lot of interpretation needs to go on. But yeah, you know, I really enjoyed doing it. I just need to finish off the AWI. I don't know, I've got another third of them to do. Half of them to do, maybe. But anyway, they're all lollipop stick downstairs, and life slightly is getting in the way this at the moment this next week. But
hooray, another AWI con.
Yeah, it looks good in 10 mil. I really enjoyed doing them. I really enjoyed doing them. There we go.
Which army is it?
British, because that's what they had. I just said, what have you got? I'll have it. And they went, we've got one pack. That's it. And it's in the van.
Oh, I see. Just entirely random.
It's red.
What theatre are you painting them for? Are you basing on a particular force at a particular time?
No, I'm just painting British AWI.
Just British AWI?
Yeah, just, and I said, Leon, give me some flags. I'll just stick whatever flags you've got on.
Right. The deeply historically researched, then. It's good to hear that. Well done, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, just paint them, stick them out, Bosch. There we go.
Hey, he's the one with the PhD. I'm sure he knows.
Hey, Dr. Wallace, yeah.
Well, there's nothing more ununiform than uniform, is there?
True enough. Oh, that sounds good. Good fun. In fairness, I've been tempted. I've been very tempted for a while on those.
Yeah, you're safe, Angus. You're going to have the grognard standing at your door with pitchforks and torches saying, what do you mean you didn't do the white regiment colours?
Nah, not bothered. That's fine. It's 10 mil, you know. Heavens, as long as it looked good from 3 feet away.
Oh, you should see Mark.
Horrific, horrific. What comment?
Well, you know, I could faff about with buttons, but no one would ever see them.
No, but cuff colours and things like that, they're essential. Identify your regiments. Come on now.
Yeah, facing colours, that should be easy enough to do. But then again, green, yellow, blue.
Some of those colours you don't see from 3 feet away, do you? Unless there's a large amount of them.
Surely that's the whole pleasure of collecting a force, is doing the research as well and getting just the right regiments. No, get them on the table, is it?
Yeah, just get them on the table. Get them looking good and on the table.
We come from a different cultural gaming background, clearly, Angus. And maybe that's another discussion for another day.
Yeah, exactly. Another pod.
You know, mix and match. Who's body? It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Just get them on the table. Get them played with. That was the whole excitement of the inspiration about doing it. You know, week of painting, get them on the table.
In fairness, a week of painting and get them on the table. Why not? Fair enough.
Bottom on Monday, on the table on Sunday.
I've been finishing off a bit of painting too, but I've managed to finally get all my elf cavalry painted up that I've been converting over the last few weeks, using the Oathmark cavalry and also lots of spare bits and pieces from all the other elf infantry sets and some gripping beast cavalry as well to make some really, really interesting conversions. So I've now got all the cavalry I need for my 1987 Warhammer 3rd edition Foreign Rom's Last Stand scenario. So I'm going to try and relive my youth again and capture being 9. And playing a game I've always dreamed of playing, and I'll probably find the scenario is absolute dross. But it looked so exciting as a kid that I needed to play it, and I never had the cavalry to play it, so now I do. So there's no excuses.
And your child's disappointment, finally.
Oh, doubtless, but
this on the cusp of your midlife crisis.
Yeah, that's it. Well, it is completely a midlife crisis. What sort of Burke would be painting old figures? Oh, in fact, new figures in this case here. Like that. So I'm going to give that a go, and I'll probably try it with some old rules and then realise those old rules are completely dated and don't work, and I'll try some newer versions of different fantasy rule sets until I find the perfect holy grail of fantasy gaming in an old school way. Or probably I'll write my own because I'm not happy with any of them, but we'll wait and see. So that's going to be a little project for the next few weeks. I'm also painting up some 2 mil Alexandrian and Macedonian forces. And I've got some beautiful little cavalry wedges from war bases that I've just picked up that they've just brought out. So I'm going to be doing those, of course, my raw strength and honour. So I'm making up those and doing some point balances. And I'm sort of aiming towards a big Galgamela refight at some point in the future and trying to get all the toys on the table. So that's what I've been doing gaming-wise, and I'm looking forward to going to Devizes maybe in a couple of weeks' time.
Well, of course, yes.
Which is coming up by Attack at Devizes. So
that's likely to be my next show as well. So which day are you going, Mark?
Oh, probably the Saturday. Probably the Saturday.
What day is that?
The 20th and the 21st of July, I believe.
Yeah. So coming quite soon. I'm just about on school holiday by that point there, so I'm allowed out for good behaviour. So I'm going to hopefully get along on Saturday. But I'm looking ahead at my schedule and I'm very, very disappointed that my normal next show after that, which is Colours, I won't be along that, which is very disappointing because I've got a season ticket for the mighty Southampton FC, now in the Premiership. Hey! And we're playing Man United at home that day. So, and it's got an early kickoff. So I was a bit frustrated. I thought I'd be able to nip to Newbury in the morning and get back down to Southampton to watch the game. But no, it's a 12:30 kickoff and that spoils all my fun. But, you know, it's going to be great fun being beaten 6-0 by Man United. So we just sing along and enjoy every moment of it with my son. So a bit of daddy and son bonding time.
That weekend of the 20th, also we have Wales Festival, which I'll be at if anyone's there. Say hello.
Oh, and there's going to be some gaming there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, and there's also gaming at Pendragon as a Leon has a participation day there. So there's loads of gaming everywhere that weekend.
Fantastic. So lots of gaming taking place there. Excellent.
How about you, Jasper?
Let's see, last month, of course, I was in the US and that flew, so that didn't produce very much. I did, but I think I mentioned that last time already, play a game with John in Virginia, which was really cool, game of Chain of Command. And since we got back, we've played two games in the Task Force Chappie. The Overlone Chain of Command campaign that Richard Clark wrote for WSS 104, which is available for free on the new WSS Online Archive, because the online articles are free and available for everyone. I hadn't painted very much since, but after we played the first game, I thought I needed more, because this, this historically was in at the very end of September, start of October 1944. So I was like, oh, my trees are too green. I need more fall trees. So I bought several dozen fall trees, and they don't seem to come cheap. So then I spent a lot of money on trees. But, sort of like Angus, I had them on Tuesday, and I had them done for the game on Saturday. Plus some fields based on Joe's tips that I made in an hour. But I guess that's for next time.
Oh, yeah. No, they look very nice. I was intrigued with your latex creations. Are they latex?
No, acrylic. Acrylic cork.
Acrylic cork, sorry, yes. Good stuff. We've also got some stuff taking place in America in the next couple of weeks as well, show-wise, haven't we? Is it historical coming up?
Yep, next weekend, I think. Not this weekend, but the one after.
Yeah, I think the same weekend as Devizes, actually. So some of us, I think quite a few people are going over there from the UK, aren't they? But I'm sure there's lots of brilliant games on, so I'm looking forward to seeing some of the pictures coming back from that.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can just fly to Philadelphia and then it's...
Expensive as a rules designer. Business expense for you, Mark.
Yeah, I don't think TFL is going to pay for that.
As we start to drift, let's leave that there and we'll be back next time with more terrain chat.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
Good stuff. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Look forward to it. See you soon.